CFO Radio is the only radio show that explores the passion of today's CFO and examines the innermost thoughts of the financial world, financial perspectives for today. Welcome to CFO Radio. I'm Lorraine Chilvers. Lee, our producer, would you like to introduce our guests, our sponsors?
Absolutely. Today's show is brought to you by Delaney Consulting LLC, providing financial leadership to fast-growing companies. Interim management, consulting services, and executive placement for the finance function. Visit DelaneyLLC.com and learn why 100% of clients describe Delaney as outstanding and excellent. Also, SAP Business by Design, a fully integrated business management software solution designed for small to mid-sized companies that want the benefits of large-scale business applications without the need for a large IT infrastructure.
This month, CFO.com announced Marianne Jennings avoided the standard warm and fuzzy lecture about ethics and went straight for the corporate finance jugular. Lapses in ethics hurt the cost of capital, declared Jennings, who's a professor of legal and ethical studies at Arizona State University. She was speaking at the Institute of Management Accountants annual meeting, and she contended that although breakdowns in corporate ethics can be costly, executives never make ethics part of the strategic business plan until they understand the whole scope of potential losses. Jennings conceded that facing up to an ethics failure can be very difficult for a company. In most cases, she said, executives are keenly aware of problems but develop strategies after to deal with them. Jennings believes that most executives do indeed have noble reasons, whether genuine or imaginary, for unethical actions. In the end, Jennings said, when a company crosses the ethical line and fosters mistrust among investors, customers, employees, and the public, the effect of its cost of capital can be severe. When you fool with trust, she warned, you fool with the capital markets. Today, our guest is Denny Beresford. He joins us today to discuss the role of the CFO more broadly as it relates to the aspects of financial leadership and corporate governance. Welcome to the show, Denny.
Thanks, Lorraine.
Well, Denny, you have an extremely long and wonderful career. I'd like to tell the listeners a little bit about your background. You are the Ernst & Young Executive Professor of Accounting at the University of Georgia, J.M. Tull School of Accounting. You've previously served in some senior roles on the board. You're currently on the board of director, I believe, of Kimberly-Clark, Fannie Mae, and perhaps previously Legg Mason and MCI WorldCom. I think that was where we first met. And previous to that, you were chairman of the actual FASB Accounting Standards Board, Financial Accounting Standards Board, and you started your career with Ernst & Young. So, Danny, a wonderful background, perhaps a little bit different from the other guests that we've had on the show. Tell us about your background yourself and why you chose the path to being a director, chairman of the audit committee, and today as professor of accounting.
I think it's probably easier to say that the path chose me, Lorraine, rather than my choosing the path. This certainly isn't something that I set out to do. But I came out of school and went into public accounting and spent 26 years with what was Ernst & Ernst initially and then Ernst & Young today. And then I was asked to consider and ultimately chosen to be the chairman of the Financial Accounting Standards Board, served two terms there, the maximum, and wanted to continue working. And the University of Georgia was kind enough to offer me a teaching position, and I continue in that. When I left the FASB, I was quite interested in joining some corporate boards, but frankly, there wasn't a lot of interest in me at the time. And that was in 1997. But in the early 2000s, there all of a sudden was more interest in people with a finance accounting type background. I think that's tied in a lot to the financial issues that occurred at that time with Enron and WorldCom and so forth. So I joined my first board in 2001 and served on five since that time.
So no dreams of being the fireman, huh?
That's right. That's right. In a way, I would have liked to have started my board career, I guess you might say, a year or two earlier, but I'm very pleased to have had the opportunity to do it for the last 8 or so years now.
So you jumped straight into the fire with WorldCom.
Yes, and had a nice, interesting opportunity there. But then after the finishing up that, I joined right from the frying pan to the fire at Fannie Mae in 2006.
So talk to us a little bit about those roles. You had said that it was your first director experience. If I can indulge the listeners, the first time I met you, I was one of several executives to be introduced to the chairman of the audit committee. We were all a bit frightened. We were going through the emergence of bankruptcy and fraud, and you sat there and listened to us and the problems that we were having in emerging from the restatements that we were going through. It was a 4 and then became a 5-year restatement. And very openly, very honest, and very humbly, you said to us, "I have served a long career with Ernst & Young, and you dozen people have just given me the worst bashing I've ever got." And we looked around at one another and said, "Oh my gosh, we thought we were generous and kind to him." So talk to us a little bit about that, the world's largest fraud and bankruptcy. Talk to us a little bit, if you can, about your role as director in the audit committee and what those challenges showed you as the role for you played out.
Right. Well, with little time passing, WorldCom continues to be the world's largest accounting fraud, but I believe Lehman Brothers is now the world's largest bankruptcy. I believe WorldCom is probably in second or third place by now. But yes, there were a lot of interesting experiences, and in fact, many of the experiences were shared at Fannie Mae accounting-wise. There, we didn't have the bankruptcy situation, but some of the accounting issues were very similar. We went through a restatement there. The numbers weren't nearly so large at WorldCom. There were something like $11 billion of accounting restatements, plus writing off goodwill and property, plant, and equipment for something like $80 billion. At Fannie Mae, it was more like $7 billion of restatements. But there were a number of things that were in common. I guess the one thing in sort of stepping back from the situation, in both cases the numbers were, I guess I would say, too good to be true. In WorldCom situation, the company of course had a nice level line cost to revenue, which was basically cost of goods sold ratio that was holding up at a steady percentage when the rest of the industry was going through very difficult times, and the board of directors really wasn't challenging that sufficiently. And in the case of Fannie Mae, it wasn't quite the same situation, but they were having nice smooth earnings when most of the rest of the financial institutions were having much more volatile earnings, which was true for the markets in general. Both of the companies had skimped on what I would call accounting infrastructure. Certainly, WorldCom had gone through, I don't know what, dozens of mergers over several years and had, as I recall, something like 27 or 28 separate billing systems, for example. Just had not done a very good job of integrating all of the different accounting systems and so forth. And so there were a number of those different things. And in both cases, the chief financial officer was, I would call him, a very charismatic individual. I joined each board after the CFO had been let go, but the understanding I had was that the CFO at the audit committee and the board meetings was just a person who had answers to every question, and the board just didn't really challenge them sufficiently. And I guess of course, these are all lessons. Things that are too good to be true usually aren't. And don't skimp on accounting infrastructure, particularly when you're going through major mergers and growing the company. And then also, a good CFO should want to be both supported and also challenged by an audit committee. And I've found that in all of my situations that the CFO shouldn't be intimidated by a person like myself or any audit committee chair. They really desire to have somebody who knows what they're doing, is willing to get in there and spend the time and so forth. But they shouldn't be one who just sort of knows everything. They should be humble and but also be very knowledgeable, but basically be willing to get in there and sort of mix it up a little bit with the audit committee and the rest of the board.
So, and you've talked about the audit committee and the role that that function plays. Having been at WorldCom and knowing that Anderson previously was the auditor and that there was a change made to one of the other big four, talk to us in terms of the role as audit committee you would have with that external auditor and that CFO. Talk to us a little bit about the changing roles and dynamics there.
Well, in each case, in the two situations, both WorldCom and Fannie Mae, the external auditors, frankly, had done a very poor job. They were very large clients for the firms, and they had the audit costs were extremely low for the size of the company. And I think they were frankly intimidated by the client. They just didn't really spend much time. They didn't really do the right kinds of things. They asked a lot of questions, but they took the answers at face value as opposed to going in and challenging things as much as they should. And then when we went through a restatement, in both cases, the new accounting firm that came in charged a huge multiple of the initial firm. And of course, a lot of that was because we had to go back and restate and do things almost from scratch, but a lot of it was simply because things hadn't been done right the first time, and the first firm should have charged a lot more. And I guess it's the old story of you get what you pay for, and I think that's another signal that the audit committee should have probably challenged, that the fees were not very substantial given the size of the company.
So should there always be that comparison to, you've used an example of, in one instance as competitors, you've used another example of like-sized firms. Should that always be in the mind of the directors?
Oh, I think that's a good idea. I mean, that's certainly, there's always the trade-off, both for the CFO and for the directors, of wanting to keep costs down. But at the same time, you want to have a thorough audit, so it's the balancing act, the proverbial balancing act of you want to have a good job done, but you don't want to overpay. And having a comparison to what peers would be charging, or the firms would be charging peers, would be certainly one way of looking at it.
Mm. Now, in that regard, as you look at the audit function and the external audit function, do you think that companies should go through a process of evaluation on a particular cyclical period of time?
As far as evaluating the external auditor,
yes,
are you saying?
Or, yes.
Well, not necessarily. That's one thing that's been discussed from the beginning of my career, which is a few years by now, and whether there should be a change of auditors from every so often, every 10 years or whatever it might be. And the compromise, if you will, that we have right now is that the engagement partner and certain other key partners for the outside auditors have to be rotated every 5 years for the engagement partner and every 7 years for certain other key partners. And I think that makes sense. Frankly, I think even that's probably a little bit too quickly. I think the engagement partner every 7 years might be a better approach, but 5 years is not unreasonable. So that brings in some fresh thinking. Frankly, there's a learning curve involved, and the first year or two around, the new partner is always learning, and they're not probably quite as engaged or quite as knowledgeable, I guess is the best way of putting it. But they have a large team of people that are working with them. But the idea of rotating the entire firm every so often, I just don't see that as something that's particularly meaningful.
No, and I think it would cause perhaps an impact to the cost that we've talked about.
Well, yes. There are, of course, firms that are always looking for business, and I've heard even recently as we've gotten past the 404 situation where firms were charging a lot and we're in a more competitive situation, I've heard that some of the larger firms are going out and telling some companies that they could do audits for less than the incumbent auditors. And by and large, I don't consider that to be a very professional type situation, and I also think it's not a healthy thing for the company in general.
No, I understand. Well, Denny, you've served on the boards of several multinational companies, as we've described. What do you think are the key challenges for the large publicly held business in today's environment? We're just coming out of a down economy. The rest of the world is picking up, and the U.S. is picking up also. What do you think is the challenge for today's large public company?
Lorraine, I don't think they're that much different from what they have been all along. Certainly liquidity was a big challenge over the last couple of years. It still is for some companies, but finding the right sources of financing for their business, but that seems to be easing up for the most part. But some of the things that seem to be more common are product innovation. The customers want the new and better, whatever it is the company is making. Competition, whether it's local or foreign around the world, everybody has competition, and it's more and more heated. But also talent recruiting and development, that continues to be probably, if not number one, certainly one of the key issues for almost every company these days.
And interestingly,
but I could have probably said those three or four things 5 years ago, and I'm sure they would be said 5 years from now as well.
And interestingly enough, Denny, that's the second time you've talked about key talent. When you were describing examples earlier in the conversation, you said that one of the missteps that they made was that they did not have the right talent, that they had not developed and invested in enough of the right people at the right levels.
Well, then I mentioned infrastructure, and I meant really more the systems, Lorraine, to be clear.
Okay.
But you're right. It does also run to having the people to do it. So the infrastructure probably was not real clear. I meant systems, but I probably also meant the people to do it as well. So that was a combination. You're right.
Interestingly enough, the last radio show that we had talking about implementation of systems and how important that is to the finance function today. So we've got a common theme coming through here. Well, Denny, the CFO role includes maintaining controls over the financial reporting of a company. COSO details that the single most effective control is the accounting reconciliation. Can you expand upon the role of controls based on your experiences?
Well, first of all, I would agree that reconciliations are very important, and it seems so basic, but that just continues to be an issue with the boards I'm on, and when whether it's external auditors or internal auditors, we just find that this continues to be an issue, that we just find cases where the details don't agree with the summary numbers in some cases, and it's something we just have to keep after. More generally, I think the important point is that most companies have their 404 work, I think, down pretty good at this point. The real point I think I'd make is that it's really important to understand that financial reporting controls are really only one part of the equation, and operational controls are probably more important in most cases. So even a company that has a clean opinion on 404 doesn't necessarily mean it's free from material error, depending on how you would interpret error. And I think the challenge for a CFO is making sure that within the organization that there's a clear assignment of responsibility between sort of what is covered by 404 and what are the other key areas of controls that are not literally financial reporting type controls, but are still really important to the business. And this gets into risk management. I think we'll talk a little bit about that in a couple of minutes. Sometimes these things, well, mostly these things are even more important than the financial reporting issues. Sometimes people sort of overlook them because they think they're covered by the 404 stuff, or it's not clear who is responsible for them. So I think the It's first of all important to understand what they are and then also who is responsible for them.
And I think you're touching on a very key element that gets into something which is very difficult for a company to look at. It's very judgment oriented. And
right.
When companies look at their controls, there is substantial judgment. And often in that regard, the company executives or whomever within the management team are discussing with the auditor, differences of opinion often come down to a different evaluation or judgment upon that element.
That's correct. Absolutely.
So how do you get around that? How does the CEO of a company or the board of directors, what is the role in terms of making sure that, gosh, the average Joe that's making widgets in a different part of the country, in the smelting factory or wherever Joe is, whatever Joe is doing, how do you make sure Joe understands controls?
Well, those judgments, I think, are more... If I'm understanding the point you're making, those judgments usually are ones that run to whether or not those things are covered by 404 or not,
mm-hmm.
and whether they have to be tested by the outside auditors. And I know there's been a move over the last 2 or 3 years to remove some of those things from the 404 testing and decide that fewer of those things are really critically important, so we can do less testing and so forth. But they're still there, and they still, whether they are part of 404 or whether they are key controls that have to be tested, they're still there. So good old Joe is still doing whatever he's doing, and whether or not it's a financial reporting control, whether or not it's a key control, it still may be something that exposes the company to some loss, for example. Good old Joe could maybe not be a financial issue, but it could be a product liability issue, for example, or a quality control issue or something like that that isn't literally a financial reporting issue, but still is equally or more so damaging to the company.
Understand. And help us understand the role of the board as you look at these kind of topics.
Well, that's getting into one of the questions we're going to cover a little later, so I guess we'll go ahead and cover that question right now. That's probably the most important thing that audit committees have been working on over the last, well, probably 2 years now, and that is risk management. And the real question is, what is risk management, and who is responsible for it within the company, within management, and then also at the board level? And, for example, the New York Stock Exchange has a requirement that basically says something like the audit committee has responsibility to oversee risk management, except if some other committee or the full board does it. So for two-thirds or so of public companies, it's really overseen by the audit committee. But some companies now have set up separate risk committees. Two of my three boards right now have risk committees. And a number of boards have the full board oversee risk rather than assigning it to one particular committee. Even at that, even if it's overseen by a risk committee or by the audit committee, there are some particular risks, for example, financial reporting risks, that would still be overseen by the audit committee, and then, for example, compensation type risk would be overseen by the compensation committee. Now, setting aside the board type exposure or concerns, the management has to figure out how they're going to identify and then manage it. So, more and more companies have a chief risk officer these days. Some companies may assign that to the chief financial officer or maybe the treasurer, or they may have a chief risk officer. It depends on the size of the company, obviously. And then they have to take an inventory of what their risks are, and then they have to decide how they're going to measure their compliance and so forth. So this becomes a major issue, and really this would be a separate program, I guess, to go into this in great detail. But the key for the board is overseeing what management is doing, not actually doing it themselves, but making sure that management has a program and is doing a reasonable job of identifying and then doing a reasonable job of protecting the company is very appropriate. That's not to say that companies are going to eliminate risk, because that's the job of a corporation, is to assume a reasonable amount of risk. That's what shareholders want them to do. But they don't want to take on an extraordinary amount of risk, you know, like the British Petroleum type situation, for example. It can be extremely damaging to a company.
Understand. And that risk role, is that part legal, part operational?
It can be. Operational is probably the biggest issue. And what's particularly of concern is the amounts or the types of exposures that no one really knows about until they happen. And the British Petroleum situation, not to get into any great detail there, but they knew it was an issue, presumably. But they didn't identify, you know, how bad it could be, or sort of what their how well they were protecting themselves. Some of the other situations in recent memory, for example, the subprime situation and the great decline in real estate prices, probably most people couldn't really anticipate that happening, that real estate prices in certain areas were going to go down 50%, for example. So, I mean, there are some things that companies reasonably should anticipate and factor into their planning, and there's some other things that are very difficult to do. No company is going to predict and plan for a meteor to hit their main plant, for example. But if you're building a plant, if you have a plant that's on the banks of the Mississippi, and the Mississippi floods in that particular location every third year or something, then, you know, that's something that you would be remiss in not having some provision for.
And understandably, when you pick up a set of financials for a publicly held company, there is that statement of risk and exposure. And maybe they don't say a meteor could hit, but there's a lot of legal language there.
Exactly.
Well, for what have we been talking about, financial expertise, your board-level experience, often we find that companies actually seek directors that have that strong financial expertise. Knowing the focus that's being placed on this experience, does that actually indicate or reflect a change in the role of the director today?
I think all boards want to have a diversity of views these days, Lorraine. In the good old days, maybe 20 years or so ago, boards were probably more homogeneous, and it might have been mainly CEOs of other companies, for example, or the bankers or lawyers who served the company. These days, I think they would prefer to have people who have a variety of backgrounds. They want to have some financial people. They want to have some marketing people, international experience. A variety of people, that they want to have at least one, usually what's called an audit committee financial expert, somebody that really understands financial reporting quite well. That can be somebody who is often has been in the past a CFO or an accounting partner, public accounting firm partner, someone like that, or maybe as a CEO that had some financial experience in their past, for example. But they're really looking for specific skills. And usually when a board is replacing a person, for someone who's retired or somebody has to go off a board for a particular reason, it's not like they're looking for the best available person. They're usually going out and looking for specific skills. And they need to meet somebody at this time who has more international experience or marketing experience or whatever. And so they're recruiting for that position, as opposed to saying, I want just the best available person right now.
Understand.
I do think, though, that it's important that CFOs should serve on boards given the opportunity. It takes a lot of time, and probably a typical board of a reasonable size company would be a 200 to 300 hour responsibility, and I could see somebody saying, gee, that's too much time to take away from my principal responsibility, but you learn a lot. And I think it's a great development opportunity. So any sitting CFO who has the opportunity to serve on another board, I think it's something they should seriously consider.
In that regard, Denny, there may be several listeners that perhaps haven't sat on a board, or maybe they've sat on a privately held board, or in their capacity as a C-level executive, they've sat on their own, they've been part of their own board or reporting to the board. Do you have any suggestions as to somebody that's looking maybe either for perhaps for that first board position? How do they approach that in terms of their career?
In other words, how do they get on a board?
Yeah.
Well, it's usually a word of mouth type situation. The knowing people who are on other boards. The most boards these days use recruiting firms, particularly larger boards, because companies have to disclose in proxy statements how they've gone about identifying candidates for the board, so they tend to use executive recruiting firms to if not identify director candidates, at least to vet them. So getting known to some of the major recruiting firms is a good idea, but mainly just doing your job, getting involved in some of the professional activities, going to some of the director type training programs is a good idea as well.
That's very good indication. I myself am a member of the National Association of Corporate Directors, the NACD, and they actually have a training program for that new director and then ongoing training to make sure that the director that's in the seat still has the ability to keep current on compensation, stock, and some of the issues that you've talked about.
Correct. NACD does a great job.
Well, do you have any suggestions as best practices in the way that a CFO and an audit committee can work together?
I have three suggestions. Communicate. And it's really just a case of making sure that you're talking all the time, meeting if at all possible, face-to-face, emailing, whatever it might be, and the other point, and this is part of communication, but it's really a joint effort. The CFO, the audit committee chairman in particular, the rest of the committee, but particularly the chairman, ought to be working together with the audit partner from the outside auditing firm, as well as the chief audit executive. They ought to be a team, and not kind of working sort of two of them together and not keeping the other people informed. And that's really the way these things work best.
And when you've done on that, communicate some more, huh?
Yes, absolutely. And it's really no big secret. It's just keep in touch with one another and make sure that there aren't any big surprises.
Yeah, surprises are not a good thing. It certainly impacts the share price.
In either direction, right.
Well, given that and some of the comments that you have made in terms of the good days of 20 years ago and today, my career certainly spans about 20-something, 25 years. I've seen a lot of changes, but there's about to be a potential huge change for the U.S., for U.S. registrants. The SEC has a recent work plan for possible adoption of IFRS, the international standards, for all U.S. registrants, and there's a very big convergence and agendas of the FASB and the International Accounting Standards Board, what we call the IASB. What's your prediction of how that's all going to work out, certainly at least maybe in the next couple of years?
It's really pretty uncertain at this point, Lorraine. My best guess is that the SEC is going to go pretty slow on this, that requiring all U.S. companies to follow IFRS by 2015, which is sort of their latest possibility, is, I would say, less than 50-50. However, in the meantime, the FASB and the IASB have as many as 12 different major projects that they're working on to so-called converge. the accounting. And this includes things like leases and consolidation and financial instruments and a whole bunch of others. And these are really big deals. And not only would the accounting change dramatically in financial statements, but the systems to develop the information for the statements would change dramatically as well and would be extremely costly. So this is something that companies have to be very aware of. The hope is that the FASB and the ISB will provide plenty of time for companies. The latest thinking seems to be that rather than requiring companies to adopt these things one at a time over the next 3 or 4 years, that they would go to some sort of a so-called big bang approach and say, okay, we've issued 4 or 5 of these new standards. We'll now give you 2 or 3 years to get your systems in place and do it all at one time. That itself, of course, would be a humongous job for most companies. So I think that it's likely that there will be some fairly major changes in accounting, and this will apply to all U.S. companies. I think it's less likely that companies will have to adopt all IFRS in the relatively near future, but I think it really is important that companies stay tuned on what the FASB and the IASB would be doing on these things and comment as appropriate on these various proposals.
That's a very unique perspective. It's certainly the dates have already been pushed back. We saw with Sarbanes-Oxley the dates were pushed back. I speak with CFOs and CEOs today, and some of them have chosen the path to already be compliant. Some of them say, we believe we're compliant, but let's just see. We haven't gone through perhaps that external audit. And some of them say, you know what, we're just going to wait till they've really firmed up the dates before we start thinking about that. We don't want to be involved in all the costs. Are you seeing perhaps that same variety?
Yes, and what I think is happening for a number of companies is that they are at least aware of what's going on. They're aware of the possibility that IFRS could come to pass, so that to the extent they are having to adopt IFRS at some of their foreign subsidiaries, for example, they're more concerned about how they're doing it there, so that when and if they have to do it for the U.S. purposes, they'll be consistent around the world. And they're also thinking in terms of if they're putting any major systems in place in the U.S. or internationally, that they're trying to think in terms of providing for the possibility of this internationalization down the road. So they're not spending a lot of time on preparing per se, but they're at least thinking about the possibility as they do other things, I guess is the best way of putting it.
I understand, and I'm sure there's a sequence of lobbyists putting their perspective in as well.
Correct.
Well, Denny, this has been an absolute pleasure. It is, I will say, an honor to have been able to reconnect with you again and to have spent some time with you today. We have one last question, and we've got a tradition on the show to ask each of our guests a CFO tip of the month. What's yours?
Mine is really pretty mundane. And my tip would be for CFOs to what I would call focus on the financials. And with all of the challenges these days with respect to liquidity and with respect to risk management and everything else that goes on, accounting is becoming extremely complicated. Even without these major convergence projects and so forth, the FASB has been issuing a steady stream of these accounting standards updates, and it's really important that companies get their financial reporting right. And my bit of advice would be, if you haven't already done so, make sure that you have a really great GAAP accountant on your staff rather than relying on your external auditor to do this. I think that more and more companies have done this over the last 10 years or so, but I still see situations where companies don't quite have the in-house talent, and they think they're doing things right, and then they get challenged by their outside auditors, and then they have this situation where it has to go to the national office of the firm, and they get frustrated with that and so forth. So I just think that paying a little extra and making sure that they have somebody who is really talented in going through the literature and knowing exactly what has to be done under the rules, and especially keeping up with things over the next couple of years is really worth paying for.
Well, that's a great tip. Thank you very much, Denny. And thank you to you for being our guest today, for sharing your innermost thoughts, not only of the CFO, but of the broader reach of that finance function.
You're quite welcome, Lorraine. I enjoyed it.
Thank you, Denny. And we would also like to thank our contributors today, CFO.com, and to our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, providing CFOs and controllers to Fortune 1000 companies and small businesses. For more information about Delaney, go to www.delaneyllc.com. And thanks also to SAP Business by Design, the software as a service business management solution for small to medium-sized business. For more information about their product, please go to SAP.com. This and other thought leadership about today's CFO is available right from your computer at cforadio.com. Thank you for listening to us. This is Lorraine Chilvers signing off until next time.